Campus FM presents Treasures from Malta. This episode was originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series, produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. Hello and welcome to season 4 of the Treasures from Malta podcast, a podcast series produced by Fondazione Patrimonio Malti. I am Francesca Balzan, an artist and art historian who goes back a long way with Patrimonio. In this podcast, I meet even more of Malta's living treasures. I meet artists, collectors and historians with some Malta connection, and we have conversations about their life in art. My guest today has packed so much into her life and has mastered so many subjects that one would justifiably think her a couple of centuries old. Except that she's not. She's an incredibly prolific and distinguished academic who originally studied and taught French. In time, she was drawn to theatre studies and dance and has approached them from so many angles through her research and papers, ranging from the architecture of theatres to costume to carnival. She has written extensively on these subjects and much more besides. She is without doubt the leading authority on the history of carnival and has produced a seminal book on the subject. She has lectured widely from Rome to Australia. She was a visiting scholar in Cambridge and has participated in seminars convened by major international institutions and academic bodies. She has also served as ambassador for Malta to Tunisia and France. She is a professor at the University of Malta and former head of the School for Performing Arts. She has been recognized by the French government and decorated Chevalier in the Order of Academic Palms. Vicky Ann Cremona, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you.
Vicky, what's your earliest memory of the theatre in childhood?
My earliest memory is actually acting in a play at school. I used to go to Stella Morris School. And I was, I think, one of the angels. And I remember holding this ribbon or curtain or something and having these uncomfortable wings behind my back and singing. It's a very nice memory, actually. At Stella Morris School, we used to put up a performance every year. And I always was chosen to take part. And I think that was really the origin of my love for theatre. And then obviously I went to the theatre, etc. But I think it really started at school.
You've dedicated years and years of your life to the study of theatre from various angles, from text, performance text, all the way to costume that is worn in the theatre, and every single aspect, including architecture of the theatre, stages, etc. But have you continued to perform?
No. No, I am not a very good actress. I think I recognize what the good actors and the not so good ones, and I'm part of the not so good ones. I love it. I wish I were better. I would have liked to direct a play, but I never got the time, because you have to be then totally focused when you're dealing with theatre, especially in the practical side of it. You have to be totally focused on it. Mm-hmm. And you can't do this sort of, you know, very
sideline. Yeah.
So I didn't, but it's something that I would have loved to do.
Never say never.
True.
Could happen one day. Vicky, if we were to sort of look back at the beginning of your academic career, you studied at the University of Provence in France. Why that university in particular?
Well, that's a very interesting story, because basically I was only 16 when I sat the exam at the French embassy for a scholarship, and I won it. But they had omitted to ask us our ages. So I was very young and I came first. And when they realized that I was so young, there was a discussion as to whether they should actually send me. And the French ambassador, who I never met and who I will be eternally grateful to, basically said, well, it's your fault. You didn't ask for the age. Mm-hmm. So now that she's got it, you can't tell her, you know, we're withdrawing it from you. And the first year they sent me to Brest, and in the north of France, in Brittany, telling me, you know, the climate is just as temperate, but the, which it is not, but basically they were thinking of the fact that it was a small university. And it was a very interesting year because it helped me learn French properly. I mean, you know, the very first lecture I ever went to was French linguistics. And I was in a state of total panic because it was bad enough listening to the French, but French linguistics and was something else, you know. And you always get guardian angels in life. And my guardian angel were two Elizabeths, actually. One Elizabeth who looked at me and saw that I'd gone pale because I didn't know what they were talking about. And she said, look, you try and listen. And at the end, you copy I'll give you my notes as long as you bring them to me tomorrow. So I started out by copying her notes at university. And then, obviously, slowly became autonomous, but I shall always be grateful to her. And I told her as much many years later when I met her again. And another Elizabeth also helped me in another course. So I started out from there. Then I met this lady from Nice who told me, what is a Mediterranean like you doing in Brest? My linguistics professor was of the same opinion. Anyway, in the end, she gave me some very good advice. She said, don't go to Paris. You're too young for Paris. And in Paris, there is a big international community. You'll never be able to integrate with the French. Go to a good university, but where you will be able to meet French people. And she advised me to go to the University of Provence. And from my second year right up to my seventh year, I spent at the University of Provence, which is today called the University of Aix-Marseille.
So you were studying French there. You didn't choose to study theatre studies at that stage.
No, at the beginning, I chose my BA is in French. But when it came to choosing my master's degree, I hesitated between linguistics and theatre and decided to go for theatre because I absolutely loved the professor who lectured in theatre. I'd gone to lectures of his about Musset and Hugo and, you know, and he was absolutely spellbinding. And so I went to speak to him and he accepted my subject. I wanted to work on the Commedia dell'arte and he immediately told me, okay, so you will work on 17th century Commedia dell'arte in France, which, you know, I didn't know anything about it, and it was very interesting.
Now, your connection with France has remained particularly strong. You have served as ambassador of Malta and Francophone countries, like, of course, France itself and Tunisia. You've focused your research in French archives and continued through the years, revisiting the archives in France, in various areas of France. And you've been honored by the French state. In 2003, you were decorated Chevalier. Now I'm going to make a hash of the pronunciation, but you can fix it for me. Chevalier de l'Ordre des Palmes Académiques.
Des Palmes Académiques.
Go on, say it properly.
Chevalier de l'Ordre des Palmes Académiques.
Thank you. By the French state. And this Order of Academic Palms is a national order of France for distinguished academics and figures in the world of culture and education. Now, do you continue to research in French archives even nowadays? And what are you hoping to find? I mean, what is your research topic?
I always try to go to the Bibliothèque Nationale de France whenever I go to Paris because I just love the place. I love to go to, there are obviously the Grande Bibliothèque, which is on the outskirts of Paris, but then there is the Bibliothèque in Rue de Richelieu, which is holy. I mean, I was very lucky because when I was studying, I was, especially for my master's and my PhD, and since I was working on 17th century documents, I had to go up to Paris and spend long periods there, 4 months, 6 months, working at the Bibliothèque Nationale. And that was the time when Michel Foucault used to work at the Bibliothèque Nationale.
My goodness.
And lecture at the, you know, at the Académie. So I used to go and listen to his lectures. And I remember the first time the first time I was there and he walked into the Bibliothèque Nationale, there was like a hush all over the room. And it was like everybody knew that Michel Foucault had entered the room. And it was such a thrilling time. I mean, I was so privileged. I had these wonderful lecturers. I managed to listen to, you know, these really great people lecturing, so at the Collège de France. So, you know, it was an experience which I will never forget and for which I shall always be grateful to the French government.
Indeed. Vic, what about your research? What were you focusing on at the time, and do you continue to return to Bibliothèque Nationale?
Yes. At the time I was focusing on Commedia dell'arte, obviously. And this is a subject that I keep pulling up and putting down again, pulling up and putting down again, because I have an ambitious project and I never have the time to carry it out.
Which is, let's just quickly mention.
Well, basically, I would like to really focus on a particular aspect of 17th century Commedia dell'arte. And I'd like to work very much on gesture. So I have to look at a lot of pictures and a lot of descriptions of work by actors or you know, people trying to describe what was happening, and a lot of engravings. And you need to be at the Bibliothèque Nationale into the Cabinet des Estampes and just bury yourself. At the moment, what I'm trying to do is really work actually on Malta. This is my main interest, because eventually, particularly with a colleague, I would like to produce a history of theatre in Malta. Mm-hmm. So my main focus at the moment is really the Maltese cultural scene, which was far richer than we make it out to be, in the sense that we're always talking about Malta being poor and, you know, and yes, there was a poverty. I mentioned that in my book on Carnival, and I actually talk about, you know, revenues and finances and earnings and this sort of thing. But there was also a middle class, which was very turned out to Europe, particularly to Italy at the time, and also a little bit of France. And basically, these people had a lot of culture. We had fantastic paintings, for example, in Malta, and painters who studied abroad. We have poets who also were published in Italy, or playwrights or writers. And I think that there is, even in the theatre, we had popular theatre, but this popular theatre was inspired by the bigger models that were being shown at the Manuel Theatre or at the Royal Opera House. Mm-hmm. They were inspired by this. And I think this needs to be taken into account.
Okay. So you probably also look at itinerant performers coming from abroad who left influence on Maltese culture as well?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And also that people read at the time. Yes. They read a lot. They read plays, they read foreign newspapers, and our newspapers, if you read the newspapers of the 1800s or of the early 1900s, the first two pages were all about international press. I mean, I read really interesting articles about Trotsky, for example. Trotsky actually publishes a whole article in one of our newspapers about communism.
Yeah, so we were very, very connected, far more than one believes nowadays.
Yes, far more.
What about Commedia dell'arte? Is it represented in Malta? Have you found evidence of it?
I found evidence of a company coming to Malta, which, looking at the list, is definitely Commedia dell'arte.
At the list of
actors,
yeah. Okay. Now, Vic, on occasion, we've talked about researching at the Bibliothèque Nationale, and the anecdotes you come up with are just amazing. And one of the things you talk about is, of course, it is like a temple to research and an archive where they're extremely strict with the way that you touch the papers, what you have around you. They protect everything with great, great care. Any particular recollections?
Well, at the time, this is not the case any longer, but at the time, the Bibliothèque Nationale, anything to deal with theatre was at the Bibliothèque de l'Arsenal. And this library was made of trestle tables, long trestle tables, and you had a number and you sat at your part of the table. And on a dais, but a very high dais, there would be these people watching you touch the documents. And if you dared lean on a document, you would basically hear a bell ring and it go ding, ding, ding. And then suddenly you would hear, if let's say you were in number 42, so numéro 42, you know, you are leaning too much on your book, or you have turned the page too abruptly. So you would feel like
shamed
in front of a whole room full of people. And if you were touching rare books, you were taken to a room, which was the rare book section. Now they have cameras, but at the time you had a guard standing for all those hours. They would change every hour. In the middle between four tables. And you would have pincers to turn the pages. Big pincers with a big end, you know, like a circle. And you had to make sure that you put the pincer very slowly in this sort of parchment which was stuck half the time.
Daunting.
Very daunting. And if you dared touch the page, you would really get it. You know, there would be, I mean, the man was paid to look at four people for an hour to stare at them.
So I'm sure they have a black book of people who would never be allowed back in, never darken our threshold again.
I tell you, you felt very, very small when you went there, especially when that bell rang. It was awful.
Shame. But Vic, you continue to research there nowadays?
Yes, I go to the Bibliothèque Nationale because I just love to go there. So every time I go to Paris, and even for, let's say, you know, 3 hours, 4 hours, I will go and sit in one of the public rooms and just, you know, whatever, pick up a book from the...
Breathe the air.
Yes, yes. In fact, when I was ambassador, people used to joke about it. That's, you know, ça c'est l'ambassadeur who goes to the Bibliothèque Nationale. Because I used to go in the weekends or, you know, or I also used to go a lot to the Centre Pompidou.
Okay.
And there I never went as ambassador. I used to join the queue and make friends with a lot of people who were queuing. People queued for an hour or 2 hours to get into the library and study. You know, it's not...
It's remarkable.
We are so privileged in Malta to have all these wonderful libraries, which are totally underexploited.
Absolutely.
I mean, for me, it is such a shame that the, you know, what used to be the Café Premier was not given to the National Library, and we didn't transform it into something like the British Library, where our young would feel the stimulus to go and then to start climbing those stairs and going to the National Library, to the rarer book section. We have a wonderful paper heritage in this country.
Absolutely.
And it is totally, totally underestimated.
Yeah. Sometimes you feel that there are more archives than there are researchers. We're spoilt in a way because they're very close together to start with. So you could spend your morning in one place, cross the road and go to another library or archive just across. And I'm thinking of Vindina, for example, in one particular street. There are at least four archives that you can visit.
Exactly. And I think also the archivists are generally very helpful.
Yes.
You know, if you ask, they're very helpful. They bring you documents themselves.
They look out for items that might be of interest to you and set them aside. Yes, indeed. The problem is that research is not attractive. It requires a lot of time. It can be very dull. But there's nothing like that eureka moment when you find something that you've been looking for a long time.
Yes, and also you find so many things you were not expecting.
Indeed.
You know, it's such a... Like today, I was at the National Archives and I found the salaries of musicians in the 1920s.
Which is so
amazing.
Useful.
Yes.
It's so useful, because it's useful perhaps for somebody else who's working in the area at the time. It's useful for you for future studies. Might not be useful right now.
But it's something you keep there on the side, you know. Like once I had found a newspaper article which spoke of this woman who had, I think, quintuplets in Malta.
Oh,
and it took her 3 days to deliver them. And this is in the 1800s.
Oh,
it was so interesting, no?
And so absolutely rare. Vic, we've touched very briefly upon Carnival, but you are synonymous with Carnival, and more specifically the scholarly side of Carnival. You've analysed it in depth as regards the artistic manifestations through the years, but also its deeper social and political significance. In fact, in 2018 you published the book Carnival and Power, Play and Politics in a Crown Colony. What is it that attracts you to Carnival? And do you follow it even nowadays?
Yes, I go to Carnival every single year.
Okay, so you see changes, you've seen changes through the decade. But what is it that really has drawn you in the first place to study Carnival?
Well, basically, I think originally because I used to go to Carnival when I was young with my mother and my grandmother, and then when I went abroad, I went to other carnivals, mm-hmm. and therefore it's something which I've always loved. Secondly, because I study a lot, my research is mainly focused on the relations between power and theatre, mm-hmm. or theatrical events. And I'm very interested in theatrical events. Carnival is a theatrical event, and there are a lot of relations between power and Carnival.
Mm-hmm.
And at the beginning, when I started out with this idea, I didn't realize that I was going to find so much. I mean, my book is 304 pages, so, mm-hmm. You know, basically it's, there is so much to say about the, I only studied the British colonial period, mm-hmm. 1800 to 1964. And Carnival was so involved in, or Carnival, the Carnivalesque, became centers of either power mm-hmm. or resistance to that power. I mean, for example, when the British imposed on the Maltese that they, in order to go to the governor's ball, they had to wear a costume, whether they like it or not, many Maltese boycotted the mm-hmm. the governor's carnival ball, mm-hmm. which was the most important carnival ball of the time. And others petitioned the governor to review this.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they didn't want to go wearing a costume. All the relationship between, for example, Archbishop Gonzi and Mintoff, the fact mm-hmm. of Dom Mintoff creating a carnival on the 1st of May.
Mm-hmm. Changing the date of carnival.
Changing the date of carnival.
Is nonsensical
also,
in a way.
Well, the point is this. It's interesting to see how this evolved. It started out because there was the referendum about integration.
Mm-hmm.
So they couldn't have the referendum and Carnival at the same time.
Well, it was proposed that Malta integrates with Britain.
Yes, exactly. So they postponed it.
Mm-hmm.
Then the second year, there was another reason for this. Mm-hmm. And I write it in my book and they postponed it. And then when there was the fight between, the British government and Dom Mintoff, Dom Mintoff decided to boycott the carnival. And when that was terrible for the people who were already participating, because this decision was taken in January and the carnival mm-hmm. was very close and people had already, you know, spent a lot of money to do their floats, mm-hmm. etc., etc. So there were people who boycotted, but mm-hmm. people who didn't.
Mm-hmm.
And the next year, the reason why it was transferred is they said, okay, now you know, so we boycott the carnival and we create one of our own. And mm-hmm. there were two parallel carnivals.
Incredible.
And then it was joined to the 1st of May celebrations, mm-hmm. at which point the Archbishop creates the Feast of St. Joseph on the 1st of May. You know, and the way the 1st of May was organized in Floriana, there was an element of show, of display, of mm-hmm. the carnivalesque in a certain sense. I mean, I'm not trying to be irreligious, but mm-hmm. I prove this in my book.
Now, that is the political ball game, if you like, of the people in power, of the powers that be at the time. But what about Carnival as seen from the people's point of view, Carnival as a social commentary on the powers, on the institutions?
Well, one of the things I was very happy about was when satire was reinstituted. And I think it is important that at one point the people are given space to laugh at their politicians. Or at important people anyway.
Yes, being irreverent.
Exactly.
Pulling down the mighty, sort of. But it seems to me that Carnival isn't really as subversive as it used to be in the past, especially because satire was, of course, suppressed. Now it's been reintroduced. But who was it reintroduced by? Again, it was the politicians enabling the possibility of satire being introduced. So in a way, it was institutionalized. When originally Carnival was about breaking rules, for just those few days you were allowed to ignore the rules or break them completely. To me it seems that it's no longer such a biting critique of authority. It's become more of a decorative, sort of joyful manifestation of the people, and it seems to be more pitched at a child audience rather than, you know, being this fine, very fine satire, which is really only appreciated by adults. Am I right, first of all, in assuming that this is the case? And is it a natural evolution that corresponds to society's less resistant approach to authority?
Once you start interfering with Carnival, you change its nature. And every time politicians have interfered with Carnival, they have changed its nature. The fact of all these shifts of Carnival have been deleterious to Carnival. Let us not forget that in the 70s, there was a whole section of society which boycotted Carnival because it was held in May. And that boycott meant that there were generations which did not go to Carnival and were not used to, did not grow up with Carnival. Because when you think that up to the 70s, university students used to create their own floats.
Fine artists were involved in designing them.
Barthé, Cremona,
Portelli,
Vella, Gianni Vella, all of them. Barclays Bank used to participate. The Civil used to participate. There were all these balls, but also these floats, you know. And that changed because of political interference. People did not hold these things anymore, did not participate anymore, and it became poorer. Now the tradition, however, I must say, is beginning to grow again, but it is growing in a different direction. But all these young children who are going to Carnival are suddenly getting interested in it. And we already have a lot of adolescents now who are at the Carnival celebrations. What is important is that our politicians have got to get their hands off Carnival. Let the people conduct it. Let's stop shifting. Let's stop playing. You know, this is a celebration which is the people's celebration.
Vic, in 2010 you were residing in Tunis as ambassador to Malta. And the so-called Arab Spring, that is the rebellion against autocratic rulers, was sparked off in Tunisia and eventually spread to other countries of the Arab world, toppling regimes and leaving a lasting impact on the political map. Now, you were an eyewitness to it in Tunis and your time there. Tell me what happened.
Well, it started on the 17th of December, I think it was the 17th of December, when we heard that this young man had burnt himself in front of a police station in a very poor area of Tunis, a very, very poor area of Tunis where there was no development. And what happened was that this person was an illegal, sold fruit and vegetables illegally. But the trouble was, a lot of young people did that to earn a living, because there were very few jobs, there was no investment or little investment into creating jobs, etc. And there was a dictatorship. I mean, Ben Ali was a dictator. And a lot of people sympathized with this. The fact that that his wares were removed from him. The fact that he went to ask for them and stood in front of the police station. People sympathized with him. And the regime did not understand this. Mm-hmm. Ben Ali only went to see this person 10 days later. And I think it was his biggest political mistake. Because in the meantime, the protest movement started fermenting, because originally people, I mean, there were also other protest movements which started, the lawyers, for example, and the actors. They were the two big protest movements. What happened was that the movement started growing, started growing, and was coming to Tunis, thanks to the actors and thanks to the
lawyers.
And the actors started going round the different towns. It was a bit of an agitprop, actually, you know. And Ben Ali, after 10 days, decided to go and visit this guy. So there was this photo in this new newspaper called La Presse, which at the time was the organ of the party. And it was a ridiculous photo. It was Ben Ali looking at this man who was completely, but completely bandaged, looked like a doll, in bed, covered, completely covered, except for two holes for his eyes, with the doctors surrounding him, everybody looking at this person. And the person looked like a doll. In fact, many people said, but he has already died. This is not true. And nobody believed that the person in the bed was the real person. Everybody, sort of the rumor was, this person has died and they are trying to keep it secret. And in fact, you know, 1 or 2 days later, there was his funeral. So people just rebelled at that point, really rebelled. And at the beginning, Ben Ali made a very big mistake. He gave a speech which was in Arabic, not in Tunisian, you know, because they speak of dialects, but in reality they are languages. And he was chiding the people for there were three speeches by Ben Ali. The third speech was in Tunisian, and it was telling them, I understood, now I know what the people want, but it was too late. The movement had grown too much.
How did you experience it?
Well, when Ben Ali left, there was this big fight between the supporters of Ben Ali and the people who wanted a change. And the only reason why there was not more bloodshed than there was because the army did not join, but the police were, the police force came out for Ben Ali. Suddenly we had shots in the street, we had snipers on the roofs, we had, I mean, the first night in my road, I didn't know that a few doors down, the so-called police station was not a police station. It was the headquarters of Ben Ali's secret police. And they came out in force on a bus, and people started throwing Molotov cocktails against them. The bus was burnt like maybe 10 meters from my door. And the, Ben Ali's daughter had a house further up. She didn't live in it, but it was her house, it was her property. And people burnt it down. I saw people carrying sofas, carrying, you know, they just
they
looted
sacked it.
In the meantime, the French embassy, I remember, had phoned me up and said, you're in great danger. You have to get out of there. And I told them, but I have nobody. I mean, I haven't got any guards. I have nobody. How am I going to get out of there? And they said, well, find a way and come to our compound. And I said, but, you know, I have my parents.
Your parents were there
yes,
at the time?
Yes, my parents were there because it was Christmas time. And
they
had
visiting.
Come to see me for Christmas.
Oh, my goodness.
And they said, no, we can't put three people up. They told me, make sure you either sit under the windows Or you sit in a room where there are no, in a space where there are no windows.
Oh my goodness.
And the only space where there were no windows mm-hmm. were the stairs. So we spent two nights sitting on the stairs. And luckily they had not put down the internet. And mm-hmm. internet was very important to communicate. So mm-hmm. I started communicating with the Maltese in Tunisia because mm-hmm. there were Maltese industrialists in Tunisia saying, what's happening to you? How are you? Mm-hmm. Et cetera, et cetera. And we kept a whole network like this. But in the meantime, I mean, there was shooting, there were bombs, there was Molotov cocktails, and the police had deserted. Mm-hmm. So the people in the streets had to mount guard in their own, for their own streets. So every street had barriers. And for you to enter, you had to open your trunk to see whether you were carrying any arms, etc. So I had a, quite an event, because the first time you're not supposed to touch an ambassador's car. So my driver wouldn't open the car, and I told him, come on, I mean, you know, mm-hmm. we have nothing, just mm-hmm. open the car and that's it. And so he did. And they were happy that I sort of, you know,
you cooperated.
I cooperated, yeah. And every night I was very grateful because I had nobody to guard me at the mm-hmm. time. And the people of the street guarded my house as well. Every night I used to take sandwiches and coffee to the people guarding our street mm-hmm. as a thank you. Mm-hmm. You know, I used to make the sandwiches. My mother and I used to make them. We'd make our thermoses of coffee and take them to them. And they appreciated mm-hmm. that. So they used to tell me, don't worry, Ambassador, we are going to take care of you, mm-hmm. you know, which was very nice of them on the other hand. Also, at the time, the ambassadors of the European Union used to meet regularly to see how the thing was evolving and, you know, and sometimes it was very dangerous. I mean, I remember one Friday when suddenly there were these, I was in my car coming from a meeting, and there were these Salafists who had just come out of a mosque, and they were really threatening and violent, and, you know, it wasn't easy. It wasn't easy, but it was very interesting to see this thirst for freedom mm-hmm. that people had, the quality of the articles that suddenly began to be written in the newspapers, new newspapers springing up, journalists who before had been silenced, suddenly, you know, taking the fore. And then obviously there were the horrible murders. So there was the murder of Chokri Belaid, who was a great journalist, but also a great trade unionist, and who was shot as he was coming down from his house. You know, there were other murders like that. It was not an easy period.
Let's take a break and we'll come back with more later. This episode, originally recorded for the Treasures from Malta podcast series and now being broadcast on Campus FM, is a conversation between me, Francesca Balzan, and my guest, theatre historian Vicky Ann Cremona. And we're back. Don't forget to go to our podcast page on www.patrimonio.org to see pictures and links to what we've discussed in each podcast episode. Now, Vicky, your tenure as ambassador both to France and to Tunisia saw you ramping up the artistic representation of Malta in both these countries. Now, it's all well and good to organize exhibitions for Maltese artists abroad, but you've actually done far more than that. Can you speak about the projects that had a longer-term effect and about the role of cultural diplomacy in general?
I am a great believer in cultural diplomacy. When the then Minister of Foreign Affairs appointed me as ambassador, this was Michael Frendo, and he told me, the French, we are just joining the European Union. The French do not really know us properly. They know us on a political level. We are small. They have their colonies as far as the economic level. The only way we can get to them is through culture. Now, you have been to France. You have a PhD from France. You understand the French mentality. You speak the French language. We need to use that to penetrate for the political and the economic side. So, that was actually my brief at the beginning. I thought it was very important to make a statement. You know, this was France. They had to they had this vague idea of the Knights of St. John and, you know, Le Chevalier de Malte sort of thing. And I said, let's start from that. Let us take a proper exhibition to France to show who we are. And then I went to the Musée des Invalides, which obviously is and the Musée des Invalides told me, look, we'd be interested in an exhibition with you, but not on exactly what you are saying. We are a museum of the army, so we have to bring forward military stuff. So we are interested if you will look at the military aspect of the Sovereign Order. And I said, okay, let's negotiate this. Let's talk about it. I had the privilege of speaking to the most, one of the world authorities on 18th century arms in the world. So I brought him to Malta and I took him to the armory. And I will never forget, because even the people at the armory were amazed. He stood at the door and just glanced at all the vitrine, you know, sort of
showcases.
You could see the showcases from afar. He just looked around and he had just perhaps done five paces into the armory and he said, I am interested in that showcase, in that showcase, in that showcase, and in that showcase.
He just sussed them out completely, the best
and
pieces.
I looked at the, you know, the people from the armory, and they told me, my goodness, he has chosen.
Yes, he homed in on the right ones.
Yes, and basically we negotiated this exhibition. The Musée de l'Armée paid for it. And paid for the insurance. Our curators took up the exhibition and it was the only time, because they had just restored the dining room of the Musée de l'Armée, which used to be the dining room for the soldiers of Louis XIV. And it's the only exhibition that has ever taken place there.
Wow.
It was in this very long dining room. We asked the Louvre to lend us, obviously, Lavalette sword, and it's very delicate. In fact, the French lent us the dagger in Malta. They brought the dagger, but the sword was too fragile. And they did lend us the sword. We also asked for the, we took the armory of, the armor of Wignacourt, you know, this, decorative armor, and we asked them for the painting by Caravaggio, but they couldn't because it's very, very fragile. They were afraid even a little transport would break it, so they couldn't give it to us, but they allowed us to use it in the book. And then we had this great adventure for, I think, 6 months. Every weekend when I wasn't working, I would go to the, we decided to create a book that was both in French and in English. And I translated the book, but you couldn't say that the ambassador translated the book at the time. So I used to go to the Musée de l'Armée every weekend. We would work on the artifacts, because then they brought artifacts from England. For example, there was one suit of armor which was pieced together by the avant-brace coming from England, and part of the you know, the frontal piece was coming from Malta,
the breastplate,
and the breastplate and the helmet was coming from France, and we recreated it all.
For the first time in centuries, probably.
Exactly. So there was all this, you know, lovely.
A real contribution to scholarly knowledge as well.
And then we got a Maltese photographer to do the photography, Daniel Celia, and a Godsdon photographer rather, and to do the layout of the book. And it was a really lovely, lovely book, and people were very interested to come and see it, you know.
So it really served its purpose.
Yes,
because it was a good introduction to Malta, to a very specialized topic.
Yes, and then we had obviously jazz concerts at the embassy. I mean,
we moved,
and there were musicians, you know, Maltese musicians in France who we used. And whose services we solicited, or, you know, if an artist was coming, we had artistic exhibitions, for mm-hmm. example, of people of Maltese origin, but who are French now, and they are artists, so we had exhibitions, you mm-hmm. know, by them too.
Strengthen the links, as always. Your background, training and experience has always been rooted in research and the arts. How did you feel about having to suddenly also represent Malta in trade and business matters and other, in a way, completely unrelated areas as an ambassador? For example, an ambassador has to take care of the issuing of passports for Maltese nationals abroad if they're caught without their passport or stolen or whatever. Sorting out issues that Maltese abroad got caught up in. Even unexpected deaths of Maltese nationals abroad. How did you feel about that? And surely there must have been some surprises for you too.
Well, there were, but, you know, the fact is I come from an academic background, so I have been trained all my life to study. And I studied very hard. I studied laws, I studied, I researched a lot. There were, you know, funny episodes, like I had one in Tunisia in particular, which was really, I think, memorable, when somebody phoned me up and said that he wanted to import camels to Malta.
Whatever for?
Well, he wanted to have a zoo or something. And I phoned up the veterinary authorities in Malta, and I was told, camels cannot be imported into the EU. They have to go to quarantine. And I said, okay, so where do they go to for quarantine? And they said, in Saint-Pierre-et-Miquelon. Now, Saint-Pierre-et-Miquelon is an island off the coast of Canada.
Talk about putting people off importing animals.
Exactly. Try and convince this guy that he couldn't just import 4 camels into Malta. And he told me, but, you know, I have left them in a field and I want to get them to Malta.
And he'll be ever so disappointed, Vic.
So, you know, that's what I think was one of the most puzzling things I had to deal with.
All in a day's work.
Yes.
But let's look at your academic work. Now, Vic, in the 80s, you taught French in Rome. Now, how long did you reside in Rome, and were you doing research alongside teaching? I mean, were you involved in the theatre in any way while you were there?
Well, I lived in Rome from 1981 to 1993, end of 92, really. And I taught French, but I also taught... I mean, I taught French at the Centre Culturel Français, and I also taught French at the Lewis University.
Now, that's quite curious. I'll stop you there. So at the French Cultural Centre, they didn't get a French person, a native French person.
They only
to
had
teach.
French people, but I was the only one with a PhD, and I was given a very rigorous examination to see whether I could speak the language properly, and I was employed. I was the only non-French.
That speaks volumes about how well you spoke French, how you had mastered the language.
No, I taught at the Lewis University for 6 years, and I used to teach, one of the courses I gave was preparing future diplomats for the diplomatic career, because in Italy there was a very tough exam, mm-hmm. and the people who prepared for this career had to sit an exam in French, and I prepared them for this.
Little knowing that one day you'd be a diplomat yourself.
Exactly. In the meantime, I got to know the people who were teaching theatre at university, mm-hmm. And I have to say they were very big mentors, mm-hmm. Particularly a person who unfortunately has passed away. He was professor at the Dams in Bologna, called Professor Fabrizio Cruciani, but there were others, you know, Professor Nicola Savarese, you know, these people really not only helped, you know, I discussed theatre and did research with them, but also they were really foundation stones for the theatre studies program in Malta, because they actually helped us form this program.
So these contacts were handy, actually, because then in the 90s you were offered a lecturing post in French at the University of Malta, as well as in theatre studies. So was there overlap here, or were they both distinct areas of research for you that you were researching in tandem?
No, they were distinct areas of research, and to be honest, I was researching far more in theatre than I was researching in French. In French, I was teaching within the Faculty of Education, mainly, and I joined the university because Theatre Studies program was founded, and because there was a call for applications, and this was the vision of Father Peter Seracino and Glot.
In fact, between 2013 and September 2022, You were chairperson of the School of Performing Arts at the University of Malta. So clearly, theatre studies and the stage won over. Tell me about the subject covered by the School of Performing Arts, and why is it called a school rather than a department or a faculty?
It's called a school because, like medicine, we do theory and practice. Mm. Our school is composed of three departments. There is theatre studies, music studies — in fact, I'm most interested in music — and dance studies. Dance was a later addition. Mm-hmm. We started out as programs within the Mediterranean Institute, but in 2012, we had long discussions with Rector, and Rector Juanito Camilleri agreed to have us as a separate entity. Mm-hmm. We are now waiting to have a building which will house all the schools, because at the moment theatre practices at the Valletta campus, dance has studios in San Juan, and music has music rooms at the university, but we want to bring them under one roof. Mm-hmm. However, there are courses which are actually interdisciplinary, that is, you know, where you do music, dance and theatre. There are lectures which are interdisciplinary. Mm-hmm. We try to bring the three elements together as much as we can, and we're always looking for new ventures.
Yes. And what about yourself? Do you are you very interested in dance, for example, and is music an area you cover in your research at all?
I am neither a specialist in dance nor a specialist in music. Obviously, I watch performances in dance and I watch performances in music. And I have headed as head of department, the Department of Dance and Music, but that's because I have good administrative abilities. However, there are three things I always try to include in my research. Elements of, if I find information about dance or about music, I incorporate it. And when I am looking at Malta, I always also look at Gozo, because there is a wealth of knowledge that needs to be tapped.
Yeah, yeah.
About theatre and dance and music in Gozo. When we consider that the main operatic seasons, or anyway, manifestations come from Gozo, it says a lot about the culture of that area of our islands.
Quite
and
right.
I think it is, I have to pay tribute to the Gozotans for all their cultural manifestations, because there are so many and so varied.
Yes, indeed. Absolutely. Vic, we keep mentioning research, and clearly it's very, very close to your heart, and something that you, I almost want to say, indulge in, because you clearly derive so much enjoyment from it. Now, I understand that you've recently been recognized for your outstanding research. Tell me about this.
I have just obtained the university's Research Excellence Fund for this year, for a big project that I am doing, which involves the Royal Opera House. And I think there has been a lot of collaboration, both from the Manuel Theatre about this, and also from particularly religious orders, in particular the Missionary Society of St. Paul, and I really thank both of them for having provided material to me. And what is interesting is that people, I keep asking people, because I'm working on scenery which belonged to the Royal Opera House. Yeah. And I have found that either scenery that after the Royal Opera House was destroyed, yeah, its scenery was distributed across Malta in the theatres that existed. And I'm trying to ask whether there are other, other sources of scenery of the Royal Opera House, because I have photographs, mm-hmm, but, it would be lovely to find other scenery. The mm-hmm scenery that I know exists has all been photographed and documented. Mm-hmm. But if there is more, mm-hmm, it's a heritage as well, isn't it?
Absolutely, and it's very, very interesting from the point of visual arts as
exactly
well.
Exactly.
Who are the painters, who are exactly, the artists who designed them and painted them. Mm-hmm. Will this result in a publication?
It will result in a documentary, mm-hmm, and in a publication, I hope, yes.
Okay. Speaking of which, publications really feature in your life. Obviously, your research is then translated, if you like, or brought together in publications. You've written books, you've written various articles, studies, chapters, papers that have contributed to this great big bibliography of yours. Your connections with Patrimonio are strong and reach very far back. You were instrumental in setting up the magnificent costume exhibition that Patrimonio held back in 1998. And you were co-editor with Nicholas Sapirov, perhaps the first book on costume in Malta, as well as writing an accompanying detailed catalogue with Evelyn Balducci. Now, both have served as seminal texts in the history of Maltese costume. I think any of us who are interested in the decorative arts have leafed through both publications and keep referring back to them, because they really established the study of costume in Malta. You've also contributed many articles to Treasures of Malta, which is, of course, our triannual journal, which has been going strong for 3 decades now. I'm told that there are some exciting works in the pipeline in collaboration with Patrimonio. Can you let us in on what is planned?
Well, first of all, I have to say that the exhibition of costume in Malta was the brainchild of Nicholas De Pira, and I think we have to give him his due. He came up with the idea and he worked on it, and I was very privileged to work with him. So for me, that is very important. Mm-hmm. It started a lifelong friendship, actually. there are various things that I'm working with Patrimonio. One is exactly working on this, on a possible publication about the Royal Opera House. Mm-hmm. And another is working on a possible publication about Carnival. Mm. So there are many things. I have always been extremely admirative of Patrimonio and the way it has revealed a new aspect of our heritage. I mean, heritage that was closed behind doors that people didn't know about, mm-hmm, which the public discovered, and which actually became a source of pride, mm-hmm, for the Maltese, because to realize that we had such beautiful furniture, such beautiful silver, such wondrous costumes, even the peasant costumes were really beautifully made, jewelry. This is a source of pride for Malta and for the Maltese. And obviously, Treasures, with its articles, keeps increasing this, because we discover all these connections we had with abroad. We discover who came to Malta. The most amazing things every time.
On that happy note, Vic, I think we can conclude the podcast. Thank you for contributing so greatly to Maltese culture, to Maltese representation abroad, and to enriching our identity with your research and with your publications.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Treasures from Malta on Campus FM. This was originally recorded as a podcast, and there are pictures and links to all we've discussed on the Fondazione Patrimonio Malti website.